September. I live in New York, surrounded by Yankees fans, and the Red Sox are in first place. So it's really tough to get any better than that. I'm glad that my family is here with me today, and I've asked my kids' permission to tell this story, so don't think I'm a terrible parent after I tell this. A few weeks ago, my kids were each given a pack of gum by a family friend, and that was nice. My daughter loves gum. She devours it ferociously. My son couldn't care less. So within just 2 days, the one pack of gum on my son's dresser is sitting there untouched. And on my daughter's dresser is a pack of gum that is in bits and pieces. Like, it's empty, all of the wrappers are there, your chewed up pieces of gum, it's gone. And so she's now decided that she's got her eyes set on his pack of gum. And I can hear from the other room, I can hear her making her appeal to him why she should get his pack of gum. And she's saying things like, you know, you don't really care about gum, and you know I like gum, and, you know, you're not even going to chew it. Why don't you just let me have it? And it starts out, you know, pretty, you know, understandable, kind of reasoned and rational, objective kind of approach. Well, he's decided that he's digging in his heels, and so he says no. And then she makes her appeal a lot more loudly. This isn't fair. You don't even care. You're just trying to be mean. You don't want me to have the gum. Why won't you give it to me? And I realize I need to insert myself. And so I go into the room, and I said, Elena, I said, you know, come over here with me. So I pull her. We're like huddling over here. It's like a strategy meeting. And I said, Elena, I know Braden doesn't care about the gum, but I don't think he's going to give you the entire pack of gum. And so here's my suggested approach. I said, instead of asking him to give you the entire pack of gum, why don't you just ask right now for one piece of gum? Because I think he'll give you one piece of gum. And then like 2 hours later, you could ask him for another piece of gum. And I think he'll give you another piece of gum. Tomorrow you can ask for another piece, and the day after that. And I said, I think eventually he will give you the entire pack of gum, one piece at a time. I just don't think he's going to give you the whole pack of gum all at once. So what do you think? And she said, well, I don't understand why he just won't give me the whole pack of gum right now. He's just trying to be mean. This isn't fair. She starts into the whole thing. And I said, Elena, listen, I'm trying to help you here. I said, do you want the gum or do you want to win? And she said, I want to win. And sadly, I know where she gets that from. I know where that stubbornness comes from. I know where that intense desire to win comes from, because it comes from me. And I have found myself in those kinds of moments throughout the course of my life. How many of you here can relate with me and with my daughter, all right? Okay. I should have probably asked it this way. This is the more fun way to ask the question. How many of you live in a home with someone like me? All right. Okay. The truth is, we all like to get our way. Every one of us, even if we're, you know, not the most competitive people in the world, we all like it when our plans work out the way that we envision. But the sad reality is that we all have to face it, things don't always go the way that we plan. Inevitably, things are going to happen to us in life, maybe like a big brother who refuses to give in, or some other circumstance that mean that we're going to have to respond to plans not going the way we would have chosen. And sometimes those are simple things like packs of gum, and other times they're far more serious and challenging. In 1981, my aunt and uncle had a little boy. His name was Jeremy, and he had an older sister already. She was a couple years older. Her name was Ashley. And together, they were forming this nice little family. And I can imagine my aunt and uncle thinking about their little son as they held him and dreaming about all the things that they would hope for him as he grew up. And, you know, we can all imagine what those things might be, thinking about what sports he might want to play or what instruments he might be interested in playing or what friends he might have and how school would go for him and what he might do for a job someday and all those things that you sort of think about when you have a little baby and you're imagining how life is going to go for them. Well, they learned pretty quickly that their plans weren't going to go as they expected. Jeremy was diagnosed with a disease known as hemophilia, which means that his blood wouldn't clot the way most people's blood is designed to clot. He lacked the factor in his blood that would cause that to happen. And this can be pretty threatening because sometimes it's a small thing like a bump or a scrape and he would continue to bleed and he'd have to get a transfusion of the clotting factor that would cause him to stop bleeding. But sometimes that bleeding could happen internally. It could go unnoticed, and it could really threaten his life. And so that meant that a lot of the things that they might have thought about for Jeremy's future were going to be different than what they thought. And so they adjusted to that for the first several years of his life, and they were handling it pretty well. But then another change of plans came along. This was the 1980s. They were living in San Francisco, and Jeremy was receiving transfusions of blood on a pretty regular basis. He was a normal boy with bumps and cuts and bruises and all of that. It was probably before screening of blood was the same that it is today. And as a young boy, he received a transfusion from a donor who had HIV. And Jeremy, as a young boy, developed HIV, which grew into full-blown AIDS. And again, all of their plans in life were changed. And Jeremy couldn't go to school anymore as his condition got worse. He couldn't go to school. He didn't have friends the way most people, young people, have friends. His friends were doctors and nurses and people in the hospital. And he lived a strong life, but a short one. And in 1996, when he was 15 years old, my cousin Jeremy died of AIDS. Now, I've watched as my aunt and uncle have handled themselves through that thing that they would never wish, no one would ever wish on anyone, and they've handled it well, but it's not easy. And the truth is that whether it's a serious and traumatic thing like that or whether it's something that's less dramatic, all of us are going to have times in our life when our plans don't work out the way we thought and our life takes a turn that we wouldn't have chosen and couldn't have expected, and we're dealing with difficulty. And so the question is always going to be, well, how are we going to handle that? Some of you are dealing with things like that right now. Maybe some of you are sitting here in this room and you just learned this week, your boss came to you and said, I'm sorry, the company's struggling. You've done a good job, but we can't keep you. Your job's coming to an end. Some of you probably have heard from someone that you love, somebody that you thought was the one or that you were already with, and that person that you love came to you and said, I don't love you anymore. It's over. Maybe some of you have had it happen where you had a son who you thought was getting his life turned around and things were back on track, and yet one big bad decision landed him in jail, and now everything has changed. Maybe some of you are dealing with a diagnosis from a doctor that everyone feared. It's the worst. We all have times in our life when we deal with things that aren't the way we would have planned them. And the question is, how are we going to deal with it when it comes? You've been walking your way through the Gospel of Mark and looking at the life of Jesus, and you've seen some of the highs and lows in Jesus' life, some of the great moments and some of the challenges that he faced. And one of the great things about Jesus is that every single thing we deal with in life, we can always look at him, and he's been through it himself. And now we're going to look today at a time in Jesus' life when he knew that the end was approaching. His life was getting ready to come to an end. He spent years now healing hundreds and thousands of people, teaching the multitudes, training the 12 disciples, but he knows that the religious leaders in Jerusalem are threatened by him. He's a threat to their power, and he can feel them closing in, and they're going to bring his life to an end. And so Jesus pulls his disciples together for what we now know as the Last Supper. And in this meal, Jesus sort of breaks the news to the disciples that it's coming to an end here very quickly, and he gave them this broken bread and said, this is my body, which is broken for you, and when I'm away from you, when I'm gone, I want you to eat it and remember me. And then he took the cup, and he said, this is the cup of the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you, and when I'm gone, I want you to drink this cup and remember me, my life given for you. Of course, the disciples didn't want to hear this news. They were in denial that Jesus was going to be going away. But he gathered them together after the meal and took them to the garden in Gethsemane, just outside of Jerusalem. And here's what happened as Jesus prayed there in the garden. In Mark chapter 14, verse 32, it says, they went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, sit here while I pray. He took Peter, James, and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. He's agonizing in great turmoil about what's coming. And he says, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch. Going a little further, he fell to the ground and prayed that, if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." Then he returned to his disciples and he found them sleeping. "Simon," he said to Peter, "are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Once more, he went away and prayed the same thing. So he went away and prayed that same prayer that he prayed before. "Abba, Father, everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." And when he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. They did not know what to say to him. Returning the third time, he said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Enough. The hour has come. Look, the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here comes my betrayer." Now, even though Jesus knew that this was part of God's plan for him, he didn't want to go through with it. And that's totally to be expected. I mean, this is Jesus showing his human side, showing what any of us would experience if we were in his place. "I know this is what is called for, but it's not what I want to do. If there's any other way, please let this pass." Now, the really fantastic news for us today is that Jesus surrendered to God's plan. He submitted to what God asked him to do, and he went to the cross in our place for our sake. And that's the great news, that because of his sacrifice, we can be forgiven, we can be set free, we are loved by him, and we have a future that is filled with hope because of his sacrifice for us. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 24 says it very plainly. "He himself bore our sin in his body on the tree so that we might die to sin and live for righteousness. By his wounds, you have been healed." That's the fantastic news. And if you've never accepted that before, if you've never let that truth become real in your life, then I would encourage you to make a decision today and make a note on your connection card and make a commitment next Sunday to be baptized, to make that a public statement of faith before everyone else and with everyone else, because there's no better choice you can make in this life than that one. And I don't want to bypass that good news. That's the result of the choice that Jesus made. But I also want to think about this choice that Jesus made and how it relates to us when we face similar times of testing. I think one of the important things to notice here is that Jesus submitted and surrendered to the Father's will at this time when the test came, when it was at its apex. But part of the reason why I think that was true for Jesus is because he'd already made that decision over and over again earlier in his life. Do you remember when Jesus was asked by his disciples how they should pray, and Jesus taught them to pray, and he taught them to pray this way? He said, and some of you could say this with me, "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Jesus taught his disciples to pray, "God, I want your will to be over all things in my life. Not my will, but your will. Your kingdom come, your will be done." Jesus taught his disciples to pray that way, and I have to assume that when Jesus himself prayed, that was a regular part of his declaration to God. "God, I relinquish my right to get my way. I am willing to surrender to you in all things." You know, when we pray the prayer, "Your kingdom come," in a really direct way, what we're really saying is, "My kingdom's got to go. I can't get my way all the time. I have to be willing to surrender and submit myself to the leadership of God in my life." And that's what Jesus had made a habit of doing. And so it's not a surprise that when the test came, Jesus was willing to say, as much as it pained him to do so, "Father, not my will, but yours be done." Now, I want to make something very clear. I don't believe that it is the case that every time God puts his plan into place in our life and we surrender to it, that it means we have to go through some terrible ordeal. A lot of the times when God inserts his plan in our life, it leads immediately to something beautiful and something good. And so let's not make the assumption that if God's asking us to do something, that it immediately means something terrible and difficult, like going to a cross. On the other hand, I don't think it's good for us to assume that every time we go through some terrible tragedy in this life, it's because God is causing it. Now, it might happen because of the circumstances of living in a fallen world. It might be because we have a stubborn big brother. It might be all kinds of reasons why we go through difficulty. But it doesn't necessarily mean that every time we go through something that God's causing it. But we do find ourselves surrendering to God's leadership, even through the difficult times. I've heard people say that when we face challenge, when we face suffering, we have a choice about three things that can happen. We can let it destroy us, we can let it define us, or we can let it develop us. Probably all of us can think of people that we know who have had something difficult happen in their life, and it ended up destroying them. It set them on a course of destruction, and Melissa's story was so helpful today because you can see how if her course hadn't changed, she was on a path toward destruction. Some terrible things that happened to her that she couldn't control, but it could have destroyed her life, and thank God that it isn't destroying her life. But we can all think of people like that. We can also think of times when people have terrible things happen to them and it defines them. It is the story of their life, and there's never another new story. I think about some of the things that are happening with human trafficking today in our world and how some horrible things happen to young people, and it defines their life. And it doesn't have to be that way. I think about my aunt and uncle and how something horrible happened to them, but it didn't define them. It marked them, but they worked through it and are now able to help other people who are going through similar things. It didn't define their lives. But the best choice we can make is to say, even when we're going through difficulty, to say we're going to let it develop us into the people that God wants us to be. And that means facing the challenge and facing the suffering and saying, not my will, but yours be done. Father, I'm going to let you lead and work in my life. Romans chapter 8, verse 28 is a great verse for reminding us of this. Romans chapter 8 says, and we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Now, it doesn't say God causes all things. It says God works in all things, even the worst of things. God works in all things to bring about good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And that means we have to surrender and submit and let him lead. Several years ago, my brother-in-law, Chris, was a medical student. He was halfway through med school. He was newly married. He had a young child, a little girl, and he was on his way home on New Year's Eve, driving from seeing family back to their home, and it was a nasty night outside. The road conditions were terrible. The roads were icy, and he came up on a car that had hit a patch of ice on the highway and spun off onto the side of the road, and being the very good-natured and servant-minded guy that Chris is, he stopped his truck, he hopped out, and he started to try to push this car back onto the road. About the time that they're in the middle of this, another car came along the highway, hit the same patch of ice, and slammed into that other car, pinning Chris between the two cars. And both of his legs were badly damaged. They were kind of a long way from a hospital, and the roads were bad, so it was hard for the ambulance to get there. And by the time the ambulance got there, he had already lost a lot of blood. So for the first few days, the whole goal was just to make sure that he would live because he had lost so much blood. And then after that, they set to work on trying to save his legs because they'd both been so badly damaged. And so for several weeks, he would go through hours-long surgeries, days of surgeries, and then he'd recover, and then he'd go back in again, and they were trying to save his legs. And then eventually, after a couple of weeks, they had to amputate his left leg just above the knee. Now, here's a person who, not only is he an innocent victim in this case, he's an innocent, good natured victim. I mean, he's out doing something that he didn't have to do. He's trying to help somebody else, and then this horrible thing happened, and he had a decision to make. Is this going to destroy his life? Is this going to define him? Is this going to develop him? Well, I'm happy to say that with God's grace and power at work in his life, they've made some very good decisions as a family. One of the things they did was they've gone to marriage counseling. They did that for years because, and I didn't know this at the time, but the statistics, people who are married who lose a limb, it's almost guaranteed that they'll be divorced within like 5 years. The numbers are sky high. It's remarkable when you see this because it so dramatically changes the course of their life that some people just can't deal with it, and it ends up destroying the marriage. And so they've worked to make sure that that didn't happen to them. He recovered for a year, and then he went back to school, and very determined, he finished his school, he finished his residency, and he now works as an ER doctor. He's done this for several years now where he's helping people who are in the same kind of crisis that he was in before. Now, everything is not perfect in their life, and they still live with some of the challenges that come that are never going to go away. But they have invited God to work in their life and let this be something that develops them into the people that God wants them to be. We don't know what's going to come our way. We can't expect the things that might change over the course of our life. But we are all making some decisions today that might determine how we will respond when difficulty comes. And so what I want to do is suggest a few things that all of us can do to make it more likely that when we're put to the test, when our plans are changed, that we'll respond in a positive way. Number one is I would just say practice surrendering in the small things. Just make it a general part of your... And I'm speaking to myself here because I am so self-oriented. I have made so many selfish decisions. I could sit here and tell you 100 times in my life when I have chosen to stick to what I wanted rather than giving in to what others wanted in ways that have hurt other people, and indirectly they've hurt me too. And I'm trying to learn how to say, I don't have to get my way all the time. And so I think when we practice surrendering in the small things, it makes it more likely when bigger challenges come that we'll handle them better. Number two, I would say prepare yourself emotionally for what it might mean to lose the things that are most important to you. I know that sounds morbid. I don't mean for it to be that way. I think about Corrie Ten Boom, who experienced some terrible things during the Holocaust and survived all of that. She writes, I've learned to hold on to things loosely because it hurts when God pries away my fingers. And so sometimes I think it's helpful to think about the things that we have as holding on to them like this because they don't belong to us. And what if they're taken? How will we handle life without them? I think it's good to prepare ourselves. What happens if I lose my job? What happens if I lose my spouse? What happens if I lose my home? Am I going to stay true? Am I going to surrender to God in that moment? Or am I going to let that destroy me? So I would say practice surrendering in the little things. Prepare yourself emotionally for what you might lose. And then the last thing I would say is, and it's very simple, but just pray the way Jesus taught us to pray. Sometimes as a family, we pray every evening before our meal at our dinner table, but sometimes we even use the very words of Jesus and just pray the Lord's Prayer so that we're saying what he taught us to say. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, in my life as it is in heaven. Now, I know we can't be totally prepared for the worst things that can happen, but I do think these are some small things we can do right now that help us to prepare for what's ahead. I want to tell you, one of the things I'm excited about with Orchard Group is that we have 7 new churches that are getting ready to launch in the next year or so in places like Baltimore and Harlem and Philadelphia and Chicago, San Francisco, Miami, Amsterdam. It's really cool stuff. One thing that's great is we have 3 churches that will be started next year in Harlem, in Philadelphia, and in Chicago that are all being led by African-American lead planters, super gifted guys, going into historically vibrant African-American communities, but they are multi-ethnic communities today, and these churches are intended to be multi-ethnic. I'm really excited about this. I'd ask that you'd pray with us for Jordan and Watson and Derek, who are going to be planting in Philly and Harlem and Chicago. But one story I wanted to share with you is from Jordan Rice, who will be planting a church next year in Harlem. And he has a phenomenal story of loss and how God's worked in his life. And I want to show you this video so you can learn a little bit more.
Life after you lose a spouse is really difficult, as one could imagine. You know, all of your hopes and dreams are kind of wrapped up in that person you set forth, and you're ready to take on life, and you assume that that person's going to be a part of the story. I got married on May 15th, 2009 to Jerron, and 2.5 months after we'd been married, he was out riding on his motorcycle and he got into an accident, which caused several injuries and led to his death. So he passed away July 30th, 2009.
I got married on August 22nd, 2009 to Danielle, and 10 months after we got married, she started feeling ill, and she got really, really ill. We found out that she had a cancer called primary cardiac angiosarcoma, and she passed away 10 months after that. So on April 23rd, 2011, she passed away. I had lunch with some friends that came up to New York, and it's my first time meeting his wife, so I wanted to just find out about her, what she did for a living. She told me that she does marketing communications, like this woman named Jessica. She said it in a way that she presumed that, oh, I know who Jessica is, I should know who she is, and I had no idea who Jessica was at the time. So when I found her online, I did what everybody does, and I sent her a friend request on Facebook.
I got a friend request from a guy named Jordan Rice, which was a name that I didn't really recognize, and so I did the normal thing where you check and see, like, who are the mutual friends we have in common, and it happened to be a couple dozen people. And the thing that made me accept his friend request was the fact that I looked at his profile and it said in his relationship status that he was widowed.
She accepted it a day or two later. I sat on my computer and it took me about a half an hour to write this carefully crafted message, something that sounded cool, not stalkerish or creepy, anything like that. Just talked back and forth about what are her interests, what did she do. I found out that she loves to cook, she loves to eat. I'm a foodie, she's a foodie. She loves to travel, she likes photography, she likes Spanish, she likes so many things that I love.
A couple weeks later, he was coming to DC and asked if we could hang out, and he admitted that he was relatively an internet stranger, but that there were people that we knew mutually who could kind of vouch for him.
The only reason I was coming down was to see it, and I made up a reason, she bought it, and we decided to hang out that Sunday.
We met up and we sat and talked the first time we met for 5 hours.
And halfway through the conversation, I just stopped and said, hey, you're incredible.
One of the things that helped with Jordan and I being able to click so quickly is the fact that we could both be very vulnerable with each other so early on in a way that only people who've kind of gone through what we've gone through could understand.
I think the coolest thing about our first date was that we both sat there and cried as the other person told their story. And to really feel for the other person, to have felt their loss in that second, to really feel deeply their loss.
I imagined that I would find someone to marry and move on with, but in that moment, I really found my mind blown. Like, there's someone out there who I can truly be overwhelmed about and excited about, and that was Jordan. I didn't really think it was possible to meet someone like him, and so every day, you know, I like to say he truly is kind of a testament of God's ability to do exceedingly and abundantly beyond what we can imagine or think for ourselves or even wish for ourselves.
It's funny when people ask us when we got engaged, because neither one of us knows what day that was. Neither one of us knows, you know, if it's a Tuesday or anything. We just made up our minds and said, all right, yeah, you know, let's do it. You know, what day would make sense for us? So we decided to get married on June 22nd to start our journey.
We're extremely excited and just very confident in what God has done in our lives and bringing us together. Having experienced really amazing relationships in our past, that made us even more equipped to know, to be able to recognize what it looks like to really get another person, to really want to commit your life to another person, to do life with another person.
Oftentimes I stop and I think that this is almost too good to be true.
I've known Jordan for several years, and so I know that the story behind all of that is a lot of really difficult days of asking why and being lonely and saying, God, I don't know how to trust you, but I will, and I am asking that your will be done in my life, even though I can't see how it's all going to end up. And I know the good and beautiful things that can come, but I also know that it comes with a lot of surrender and submission and prayer. And so I just want to close by inviting God to give us the power and the courage to let him lead and let him be the king in our lives and surrender to him. So let's pray. Father, you are capable of amazingly beautiful stories and such good things that can come out of deep hurt and tragedy. And we're thankful to you for that. We're thankful for your work in the lives of people like Melissa from earlier, Jordan and Jessica. And I thank you for the work that you're doing in our lives today. And Father, I don't know, you do know, I don't know all the things that are going on in the lives of people who are here this morning. And so those who are suffering and facing challenge and testing, I pray that you give them strength and courage right in this moment to keep going. And Father, for those of us who may not know what is right around the corner, I pray that you help us to put things into practice today that will allow us to follow the example of Jesus, to follow his lead and say, I'm going to trust you. Your will be done in my life.